Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to EMForum.org. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your host and moderator today, and we are very glad you could join us. For any first-timers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. We do want you to take part in this discussion. If you need assistance, please select Help Desk from the drop-down options in the Q&A panel or the chat panel, and our associate, Lori Weber, will try to assist you. As we are painfully aware, terrorist incidents of the kind experienced in Boston continue to be a threat. We thought it would be a good time for an update, and our program today is condensed from a much longer training session. So therefore, we will begin with an overview presentation and pause for questions on the first part of the material halfway through. Then we will proceed with the second part with a final opportunity for questions and comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the first Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your questions or comments until we do get to that part of the program. You may wish to make a note of any questions you have as we go along. Today's recordings and a copy of the slides will be available from our site later this afternoon, and a transcript will be available early next week. Now, it is my pleasure to welcome back August Vernon, currently the Operations Officer for the Forsyth County Office of Emergency Management in North Carolina. August returned to his position in 2005 after a year in Iraq as a security contractor conducting route clearance and long-range convoy security operations for the U.S. Army. August has been employed in emergency management for 13 years and also served as a paid member of the fire service and as a fire service instructor. He also served in the U.S. Army as a chem, bio, radiological, and nuclear operations specialist for 4 years. Welcome back, August, and thank you very much for joining us again today. And I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
All right. Thank you, Amy, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Also, I'd like to say good afternoon or good morning to everybody who's listening in, depending on where you're at. We do have a lot of information to cover, so I'll move through this fairly quickly. Again, our focus is going to be on terrorism response operations, but I'll cover a couple different topics related to this, see if we can get this to move. All right, we all definitely recognize that to have a rapid, safe, and successful response to any type of these incidents does require some planning, some training, and preparation on the part of the communities and the agencies that would be involved. If the moment the device goes off or someone opens fire with a weapon or releases a suspicious powder, that's not the time to start to figure out what your game plan is going to be. Now, statistically, the likelihood of a terrorism or even a mass violence incident is low, but definitely public safety officials and others need to plan and prepare for these events. So obviously, with the continuing events that are occurring, both CONUS and OCONUS, which basically means inside and outside the United States, have definitely demonstrated the need for us to continue to plan and prepare and respond to these events as they occur. Again, I have a lot of information to cover very quickly. This class is normally either 4 hours or 8 hours in length, so I've just kind of highlighted a few key bullets here that we'll cover within the webinar. Also, always want to remind folks that we still have troops in harm's way overseas. We have had fatalities related to the military overseas, and including Afghanistan continues to be a very dangerous area. So obviously we want to make sure that we remember our folks that are on the front lines basically worldwide. All right, so the purpose for today's event is really just talk about some trends in terrorism and mass violence events. We'll talk about maybe some current and emerging threats that are out there and talk about a couple resources and plans that could help you in your planning, training, exercising efforts for these type of situations. This is obviously webinar is not meant as the only complete training in and of itself. There's plenty of good other resources out there to help you. So with all the different type of agencies and entities that are on the webinar, I'm not really trying to tell you how to train and plan, but rather what you need to plan and train for, depending on your location, your mission, your resources. All right, anytime we want to talk about any type of violence-related situation, terrorism, mass violence, active shooter, mass shooting, whatever it is, explosives, we always need to talk about who is the threat and who do we need to focus on. Who's the threat and what risk are they? So obviously there's a wide gamut of those that we'll cover that could cause some type of terrorism or mass violence incident to occur. So we'll kind of look at this, kind of call this terrorism 101, and we'll look at the type of adversaries that are out there. The first one is obviously international terrorist groups, and we'll take a moment to break these down in a little bit. Domestic terrorist groups, criminal elements, gangs, which really has a transnational focus now, the domestic militia groups, extremist groups, and probably the top three that we'll need to talk about is, number one, the homegrown violent extremists. That's what we have recently been seeing within the United States. The lone wolf, and there's a couple definitions of a lone wolf, and the insider threats. And most of your school shootings, workplace shootings, mass murders are from what we refer to as the insider threat. We could spend an hour on each one of these groups on this list of adversaries, but we just don't have the time to do that. So think of a threat matrix and who are we realistically need to be concerned about. So again, terrorist groups 101 in this methodology has been around for a long time now, breaking it down, international terrorism and domestic terrorism. The international terrorism are your state sponsors. Those are countries that are funding and supporting terrorism activities. Your formalized terrorist groups, your Hamas, your Hezbollah, your ETA, and some of the other well-known groups. And then what we're really seeing now is what's called the loosely affiliated international radicals. And that's sort of where Al-Qaeda is now. Al-Qaeda is no longer a well-bid organization with a strong structure, but more of a franchise now. Also, your domestic terrorist groups, your right-wing, left-wing, and special interest, and we'll talk about those groups. Also, in today's world, really, there is a great number of emerging threats. Things are changing. That's why you'll hear me refer to this both as terrorism and mass violence incidents. Some of these incidents may not meet the legal definition of a terrorist attack, but they really seem like a terrorist event when the agencies need to respond to them. So there's a couple things going on now. There's really a wide variety, assortment of actors and groups, both within the United States and around the world. There is a big criminal tie-in into these groups in today's world with the drug trafficking, human trafficking, financial crimes, and things like that. And a lot of groups that maybe used to not speak together, work together, are networked in some form or fashion. And a lot of these groups now are very information technology, social media dynamic, very strong in those efforts, and we have to be aware of that. A lot of this, again, is organized crime now that are supporting terrorist groups and organized crime that is actually conducting terrorist activities. There is a religious nexus to some of these groups, the rogue states that are out there, countries that really don't have strong governments, banking structures, customs and border protection, things like that. Non-state organizations, which are some of these groups. WMD, there's still an attempt from some of these organizations to try to produce WMD of some form or fashion, and we still need to be concerned and focused on that. And probably the biggest one, I think, that we're seeing that we need to be focused on in the United States is the domestic, the homegrown terrorists, that homegrown violent extremists. Most of the attacks that have occurred in the past few years in the United States and the attempted attacks and those that were stopped are domestic and homegrown. And all this fits under sort of this asymmetric warfare umbrella. Obviously, Al-Qaeda cannot meet the military on the battlefield with tanks and aircraft, so they use roadside bombs, IEDs, civilians as hostages, social media, things like that, what we call the asymmetric warfare. So the snapshot, the window of things that we're looking at are definitely changing. Also, just kind of food for thought, we can't spend a lot of time on this, but things that are going on in Mexico, I would definitely recommend for you to kind of look into that. There's a lot of things going on in Mexico and on the U.S. border. as related to this narco insurgency that's taking place down there. Over 50,000 people have been killed. They're using roadside bombs, social media and technology. And one interesting one I just wanted to throw into our discussion on terrorism is there have been a lot of the IEDs, improvised explosive devices, being used in Mexico, some right on the U.S. border. And there have been several situations. I won't call it a car bomb as we imagine car bombs in Iraq and Afghanistan, in the Near East and Far East, 500 to 1,000-pound car bombs. But some of these pictures you see, they have had explosives placed into vehicles that have gone off. The picture on the left with the officer running, that was a device that was specifically set up to target police officers. There was another recent car bombing down there. Again, not large in size, but improvised explosive devices placed into vehicles to target locations or individuals. So I think there is potential that we could receive bleed over in the United States for this type of event to take place. So there could be the next IED or car bombing in the United States. May not be terrorism related, but could be related to what's going on in Mexico. And again, we look at the threat matrix, we look at the history, the intent, the capability, and these are occurring, and some of these actors and individuals involved in this are within the United States. So if you remember, I talked about domestic terrorism and international terrorism. First, we'll look at the left-wing groups, primarily pro-communism, pro-socialist type groups. And again, we're talking about extremist, subversive groups that are involved in criminal activities. A lot of this may have transitioned into what you've heard called anti-globalization in the past few years. With the recent elections, the RNC and the DNC and events like that, there was a lot of anarchist violence related to this. So these groups, a lot of them will use protests and civil unrest with what they call direct action. And if you look at the history of some of the Occupy events that took place, and again, this is not painting all the Occupy events with one brush, but there were some that did have explosives found, bomb threats, suspicious materials, assaults and murders and violence and other criminal activity that was related to this. So a lot of this, again, would fall under this anti-globalization or anarchist activity. And who would be conducting that? Again, it could be that lone wolf, it could be that insider threat, or it could be that homegrown violent extremist. A recent plot was in Cleveland. The individuals that were looking at possibly blowing up a bridge in Cleveland using explosives, they also were maybe going to target the Federal Reserve Bank with a possible car bomb. And again, these are U.S. citizens belonging to conducting U.S. subversive activities, no ties to any international terrorist groups or anything like that. So this would fall under that left-wing umbrella. Now, to go to the far end of the spectrum is the right-wing extremists. And again, we're talking about groups that are conducting criminal or subversive activities. Now, under the right-wing extremists, that could be a lot of different things. White supremacists, gun control extremists, the New World Order. Kind of keep your eyes and ears open for New World Order. You used to hear this years ago from the right-wing groups, when their belief was on Y2K in the year 2000, that the world would come to an end as we know it, all computers would crash, and the United Nations would take over. And that was kind of the big buzzword and the focus on these groups. And then, of course, on Y2K, nothing happened. So that term went away for a while, but it's kind of come back again, New World Order. So you will see some of these groups referring to that. Some of the groups, anti-government, some anti-taxation, some anti-abortion. Again, it depends on the group. Some are militia groups. Some, and I don't even like to use this term patriot movements, but that's most patriot groups are not extremist and subversive. Obviously, they're not, but some of these groups will use that name. And kind of an issue that's been around a while but seems to be expanding is the group called the Sovereign Citizens. The interesting thing about sovereign citizens, there are some groups that are black members only and some that are only white members only. So within the sovereign movement, there is a lot of different type of individuals out there. But there have been ambushes and attacks on law enforcement that involve fatalities that have involved these sovereign citizens, and they are kind of widespread and growing. So what are the, just like we talked about the left wing, what are some of the beliefs of right wing groups? And again, there is a wide variety of these organizations. Some groups oppose the U.S. government in any form or fashion. Some believe the U.S. government has already been taken over. Some of these groups already believe they are their own government and do not have to follow or listen to any other government. Some of these groups are driven by very strong, what we would call a Christian identity, religious beliefs. Again, this is extremist, criminal beliefs. There are still a segment of these groups that have a very strong Nazi or fascist government type of ideology. And some are very, very patriotic individuals, but obviously are taking part in terrorist and or criminal activities. Now, who could be part of the right-wing movement? It could be the lone wolf. It could be that insider threat, or it could be the homegrown Von extremist individual, cell, or group. And probably the most popular and the one we see maybe the most issues from is what we call the special interest or single issue group. And my answer for this is pick any controversial topic that is out there. And I have seen a lot of groups and individuals that are conducting criminal activities related to any controversial topic you can imagine that's out there. And it could be the animal rights, environmental issues, genetics research. There has been violence on both pro-abortion and anti-abortion, gun control, anti-RS. Recently, a lot of focus on the banks and financial institutions, some groups and individuals that are against corporations and corporate world. So pick your topic, any topic that is controversial, and you can have groups that are, you know, subversive in their activities related to that topic. And I am kind of covering these groups very quickly, so we have time to get through the whole presentation, but we could spend a lot of time on each one of these groups. Also, we have a lot of participants from different parts of the country. You would need to find out in your state, in your region, in your area, whom out of these groups is active, who's protesting, who's marching, who's conducting Occupy events, who's posting things on the Internet, who's presenting through the social media world. This is one thing you need to find out that would directly impact your threat assessments, your vulnerability assessments, your planning and training efforts. Now, we're talking about all these individuals, and we're painting them with a broad brush here, but some of these terrorist incidents can be very sophisticated in the degree of planning execution that's going into them. Many of these individuals have trained, prepared, armed themselves, have very detailed plans in place, have the financial backing. But honestly, these attacks can be carried out by individuals with very little training, very little planning, very few resources, limited funding. I think we sometimes make these individuals out to be criminal masterminds, highly trained terrorist organizations, and they're not. That's why most of the time these individuals are going to use readily available weapons, such as pistols, shotguns, and rifles. If they're using explosives, they will be using homemade explosives, HME or improvised explosive devices, and I'll talk more about those after the first Q&A. We saw that with Fort Hood, which, in August's opinion, Fort Hood was not a workplace violence attack. That was a terrorist attack. That was using readily available weapons. The Boston bombing was using readily available homemade explosives and IEDs. Our school shootings, our mass murder attacks, the recent incident in California on the campus, that was using readily available weapons and those type of materials. So we sometimes need to realize these guys can pretty easily access a lot of the things that they would need if they were planning or preparing to do some type of attack like this. Again, who could this be? It could be the lone wolf. It could be the insider threat, or it could be the homegrown Von extremist type of individuals or cells. So with all this bad news, and what do we do? How do we plan? How do we prepare? Now, I think the first thing in any community or location is just to kind of have a clear idea. What are we going to do? Number one, if a threat comes up, a lot of times in our planning, our training, our exercises, we always focus on, boom, the bomb has gone off, or the school shooters opened fire. We always need to focus on the threats. Nadal Hassan at Fort Hood there were threats there. There were threat assessments done. People were aware of this individual. Our Boston bombers, there were threats there. These individuals were investigated. They were on our radar. Cho at Virginia Tech, people were concerned about him. He was on the radar. So I think a lot of our efforts, we need to start looking at, you know, the intelligence and information sharing and what do we do when someone makes threats and things like that. So the first thing we really need to do is, you know, kind of review your guidelines and procedures, or do we even have guidelines and procedures? We don't want to have to respond to either one, a threat or an incident off the cuff with no planning or preparation. And as with any multi-hazard assessment or planning process, whether we're talking about plane crashes, ice storms, floods, or hurricanes, once we have some type of plan in place, and remember, guys, we don't judge our plans based on weight, we need to do some type of multi-agency exercise, a tabletop or functional. I did a local law enforcement agency's critical incident tabletop exercise yesterday. It took 3 hours. So it's always good to do these exercises once we have plans in place. There's a couple ways to do tabletops. These are some of the ones that we've done with a little command school, Abbottville-type tabletops, little cities that we set up. These actually work very well to use communications, ICS. You can pick any scenario you want, all the way up to, this is a big tornado-related exercise we did here in our county 2 years ago. So, and we conduct multiple exercises every year, a variety of those type of exercises. So, again, put a plan in place. Once the plan is placed, do not put it on the shelf. Let's exercise it. You know, let's start with tabletops and work groups and simulations, and then build these up to the full-scale functional type drills and exercises. And, Amy, I will stop at this point because we're kind of at midpoint.
Thank you very much, August. We'll give you a little break here and see if anyone does want to go ahead and ask a question or make a comment on the material that you covered thus far. Okay. To ask a question or make a comment, please select host from the drop-down menu in the Q&A panel and then type in the area underneath. And I'm going to go ahead and close the chat panel at this point to make it easier for you to find the Q&A panel or to view it. All right, and then I will read the questions or comments aloud, and August will respond via the telephone bridge. Please do keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. And we are ready to begin now, so please enter your comment or question at any time. And we will pause just a moment or two to see if anyone does have something they want to cover right now. Obviously, we've had a history going way back to Atlanta with these improvised devices. And just a reminder, again, a homegrown situation there. So.
Yeah, and I'll remind everybody, as soon as this middle Q&A is done, I'll jump back into planning a little bit, and then we'll talk about IEDs and homemade explosives and some things going on there.
Okay, I do have one for Carolyn Wells, who asks, how do we get information on our regional threats?
Okay, that's a good question. First of all, I would certainly reach out to, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do this, and it may depend on, are we asking from, I'm in the corporate world, I'm in law enforcement, I'm in military. You know, there's a couple ways to do that. Number one, I would reach out to, is there some type of fusion center, you know, these intelligence and information sharing around. You know, I would reach out to them, hey, what kind of threats are we facing? And you don't need classified information to know what's going on with whether it's criminal elements, organized crime, things like that, threats. So reach out to your local fusion centers. Reach out to your local gang units. A lot of law enforcement agencies have a gang unit. Some have intelligence groups. You know, reach out to them. Again, you have to, you know, you have to have a need to know, right to know, justification while you're looking for this information. But it's okay to share this information with the right party. So it's all, number one, it's always good to network with these people anyway. Every state has a gang association, and a lot of the gang associations and groups do focus on extremist groups and subversive groups that are out there, or subversive groups that are out there. So it just kind of takes a little research. There's other organizations out there, private entities and organizations that you can look at. You can sign up through bulletins through the Department of Homeland Security. There's a couple good books out there. It's just kind of, there's no one way to do this. It's sort of a never-ending process. But I would reach out to your local and state law enforcement first and look to your fusion center.
Good suggestion there. We've got a couple more, but they're really not on the material that we've covered thus far. So, folks, I'm going to save those to the end if you don't mind. And I think we'll go ahead and turn it back over to you, August.
Okay. All right. Well, save your questions up, and we'll try to answer them. And I've had questions, lengthy questions before. I would certainly be glad to, you contact me offline if we can't get down in the weeds here, but I'll be glad to help anybody out, offline next week or whatever. So, all right. We'll continue on. Anytime I do anything on critical incidents, crisis management, disasters, high impact incidents, the first thing I want to say is avoid what I call death by ICS. I also teach the ICS courses, and I don't like how in even some of the most simple and basic classes that we're introducing someone in a one-hour class to ICS, and we show an org chart that has 40 positions in it. I have very rarely seen that many incidents that have this many ICS positions filled. So I think it's important we know how the structure works. And obviously you will expand ICS as needed. And I sometimes think that people think within the first 10 minutes of a critical incident, no matter what it is, that we need to build all this out, and you don't. So I call that avoid death by ICS. And obviously in a fast-moving terrorism incident, active shooter incident, any type of mass violence situation, it's going to take a very strong command and coordination and communications to manage that. And the ICS is the way that you do that. What I always recommend, let's focus on, and this is one example I put. Even to this day, organizations and agencies struggle to establish a unified command when an incident happens. I think there was a tremendous response in Boston because they already had a command post set up, resources in place, and within 18 minutes, every single victim living and deceased was gone. That's amazing. And I think because they had a strong incident command system already established. But we, to this day, with all the training and the resources we put to this, we still struggle. But let's not focus on this. Let's just focus on this, getting those key members together to establish that unified command that we talked about. And this is just one I put together to build that command staff on any generic terrorism incident, or fire incident commander, a law enforcement commander, an EMS incident commander. Obviously, in today's world, with the speed of media, social media dynamic, you'll have to have PIOs there very quickly. Establish a safety officer, liaison officer. That's what our office does. We respond to incidents. And all your agency representatives. And from there, we can start kind of building out operations and things like that. But let's just focus on this initially and not this. We'll get to that. The only time I've basically seen this, I think, was at a couple hurricanes I've been to, and I spent a week in Charlotte for the Democratic National Convention. But we had 6,000 responders in Charlotte, and you needed this type of command structure to manage it. But let's focus on this. Also, out of the hundreds of ICS forms, you definitely have to have ICS to manage these, the school shooting or the mass shooting or the bombing. The one form I want everybody to be familiar with is that ICS 201 form. I like the 201 form for a lot of different reasons. It's four pages, front and back, and it's very easy to use. You're going to be writing this stuff down anyway, but typically you're writing it on a gloved hand, on the back of a run report, on a piece of paper. I've been on incidents where we're writing stuff on receipts out of someone's car. The 201 form is a quick scene map sketch with north oriented. What's the situation summary? What are our current objectives? What are we doing? Who's here? And the current org chart. This takes 5 minutes to fill out. That doesn't mean the first 5 minutes of an incident you start worrying about filling this out, but No matter how big the incident, big or small or fast moving an incident is, someone initially has got to take command of that and establish that unified command and start setting up staging and calling for resources. So I like the 201 form. Don't worry about all the other dozens of other ICS forms. We'll get to those, but let's initially focus on that 201 form. Those are available, hard copy and Excel, PDF, Word. I've seen all kinds of different versions of that. Now, we'll kind of transition, I'll get off the ICS soapbox and transition into explosives. And yes, that is the materials that the underwear bomber, or what we call the Christmas bomber, did use or attempt to use on the aircraft. Why do bad guys, and I'll use the term bad guys or adversaries, like explosives? There's a lot of different reasons. And, you know, these are some of the main reasons from the Boston bombing. Number one, it's easy to make these things. If I can cook meth, I can make bombs. I can make explosives. Not detailed and complex explosives. Some of them will injure and blow themselves up, but they are pretty simple to make. They're very low cost to build. I don't have to have a lot of financial resources to do this. The plans are literally all over the Internet. I can get them in books. There's how-to videos. The extremist groups will put these videos out, how to make this stuff. The parts, materials, and chemicals to make these are very, very easy to get, very low cost. So, again, from just easy to do for them. Very, very high impact. Obviously, Boston was very, very high impact, very well recorded, and that's what they want. They want a lot of attention for whatever reason they're doing this. But bombs, even small devices, are very high impact. In fact, you can make a fake bomb, put it somewhere, and it's going to get a lot of attention. So there is a lot of attention on all these devices. There's a lot of different delivery options. A person can carry it. A vehicle can carry it. I can put it in a bag. I can carry it with me. I can hide it in something. I can put it in a fire extinguisher. There's literally hundreds and dozens of ways to deliver explosives to a target. I don't need a large group of individuals to do this. I don't need a large cell. And it can be difficult to identify the perpetrators and facilitators of an explosive attack. Very difficult forensic examination. You can recover the majority of materials used in an explosive device, but it is difficult to do the forensic examination. And this is the same reason these individuals use these against our forces, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan. Easy and low cost to make. The majority of terrorist attacks around the world utilize explosives, and these are the reasons why. Majority of our troops that have been injured and killed in Iraq and Afghanistan have been killed or injured by explosives for the reason we've already talked about. And explosive devices can consist of anything from these homemade explosives, IEDs, pipe bombs that we talked about, to very sophisticated military ordnance. But most first responders, what are we going to run into in the United States? Homemade explosives and improvised explosive devices. That's really the current and continues to be the emerging threat. You know, we do get warnings every year on the possibility to be alerted of different type of explosive threats. And we get these every year and have even before 9/11. And most of the time the bulletins state there's no specific or credible intelligence indicating this is going to happen. But obviously with the growing use of these, both overseas and what we've recently seen in the United States, it is definitely a cause for continuing concern. Now, I just want to throw out to you, and you don't have to write these names down, but kind of sort of the popular formula recipe to use right now that is a lot more powerful than your normal black powder, gunpowder, flash powder type of devices is what's called the peroxide-based explosive, and you may have heard this. The two most common is trazodone triperoxide and hexylmethylene triperoxide diamine, and I did have to practice to say that. That's why I just write down TATP and HMTD. These are very, very powerful explosives that can be made from pretty much over-the-counter household products. And sort of this is the improvised explosive material choice right now among a lot of different type of extremist subversive groups for a lot of different reasons. But it is very inexpensive, very low cost, pretty easy to make, though this stuff is extremely dangerous for the maker. and it is very, very powerful. And that's how you need to remember with these individuals. If someone makes this and you find this stuff, even if they turn themselves in and have made this, you have to be very careful with this stuff. It will go off for a lot of different reasons just sitting there with these peroxide-based explosives. Also, something we need to be concerned about, in my time in Iraq, we unfortunately were confronted with IEDs before, and the first thing you need to think about once one goes off is where's the next one? When's the second one coming? So we obviously want to train responders and plan on secondary devices. I know in listening to the Boston tapes from the response, you very quickly heard people making comments about be cautious of secondary devices, leave packages and bags on the scene, get everybody out there as quick as possible. Because, again, if you have an actual device, whether detonated or undetonated, you've always got to think of secondary devices. That is their entire purpose in being, is placed on scene to cause death and injury among responders. So in this homemade explosive, IED type of attack, you know, remember, we responders can be targeted and have been targeted before. So obviously we want to maintain situational awareness. You've got to start thinking almost like military force protection. If this happens, you need to look around your immediate area. Establish that unified command post. Check your command post staging and triage areas for secondary devices because they will put them out there. You talked about the Olympic bombing. Eric Rudolph did put out secondary devices to target first responders. You know, those have been found in the United States. I just want to throw these out. This is from the Columbine High School attack in Littleton, Colorado. Cleveland and Harris, the two students that were involved in the attack, those two young men did make over 99 different type of improvised explosive devices. They didn't have a lot of money. They didn't have a lot of training, but this shows how simplistic this really is and how it can be done. Fortunately for us, and you can see these pictures, they did make some propane-type devices a little larger, very similar to a couple other incidents that have come up in the United States, including the Times Square bomber, but they were unable to get their propane devices to function, which could have caused a lot more issues in deaths and injury. But, again, not that difficult even for young people to do these things. Really, though, the most common explosives that are out there is your black powder, smokeless powder, and your fireworks. Why is that? Because this stuff is easy to get. You know, these are all useful, good products, but obviously people can use them for the wrong reason. And still the most common device that's still found is the pipe bomb. So if you find a pipe bomb or respond to a pipe bomb, you still need to treat that as very high threat, high risk. Again, this stuff is easy to find. You go to the hardware store, you get it, and you can make this stuff in 10 minutes and you're done. And it's very dangerous to the maker, the responders, and the public. When responding to the explosive incident, you have to look at it a couple of ways. There's what's called pre-blast, which most of us respond to on a regular basis. This is your bomb threats, your suspicious packages and powders. Well, not packages or powders, but suspicious letters, packages, bags, and things like that. These happen on a fairly rare occurrence. Post-blast, that is the actual response to an incident when a device has gone off. Again, always considering secondary devices. Continuing response. This is what was happening in Columbine. During their mass shooting, mass violence attack, they were throwing explosive devices. This happened in Beslan, the school takeover in the Soviet Union, Russia, Mumbai, India. That's what recently happened in Boston once the law enforcement confronted the two suspects and there was the shootout. These individuals were throwing explosive devices. So that is a continuing response incident. I think we're going to see a lot more training on that here in the near future because of what happened in Boston. And, of course, we always want to anticipate a secondary device. Everyone should recognize this. Everybody remembers the old radiation, your RAD training. Get out the yellow radiation monitor and remember your time, distance, and shielding. And I think this also applies to explosives incidents. You obviously want to minimize the time spent in that affected area. get in and get out, get the victims out, those type of things. Distance, you know, do the old thumb check, but maximize distance from those materials or suspected materials. And shielding. Put buildings, fire trucks, as many things between you and whatever the issue is. So think of our time, distance, and shielding. And again, I'm just kind of highlighting some key things here. Remember, these classes are normally 4 to 8 hours in length. I'd also like to pull things out we're already all familiar with. And if you've had hazmat awareness officer technician, you're familiar with your zones of control, your hot zone, your warm zone, and your cold zone. Let's take that same hazmat methodology and apply it to an explosive incident. Your hot zone is where the blast took place and where your damage and injuries have occurred. Your warm zone, that's where we're going to start establishing our perimeter area, whether it's 100 yards or 1,000 yards. And the cold zone, that's where we're going to have that unified command post, staff, resources, triage and staging and things like that. This is a picture from Iraq, and why I put this in here, I did not take this picture. I was at this incident, but I did not get this close to it. This is just actually we were what's doing route clearance where you're basically you're driving around looking for IEDs. Not the safest job in the world, but we came upon this V-bed that had detonated, and they took this picture, as we call it, EOD on this. And why we tell people, even if the device has exploded, you need to be very careful. You can see here, even though this V-bed car bomb had gone off, you can see shells that are still laying there that have not gone off. And those are dangerous. Those are hot. You don't know what's inside of those. They've been thrown around, blown up. And so those could be very dangerous. Someone on my team took that picture. I obviously did not get that close to that. But this is why we say, in Boston, any of these incidents, you've got to get away as quick as you can. Get victims out. Leave bags. Leave stuff there. Don't touch trash cans. Get the living and dead out of there as quick as you can. So kind of some closing comments here on that. First responders should never, ever, ever, never, ever attempt to move, handle, approach, or disarm a confirmed or suspected IED or homemade explosive. Don't touch the stuff. Leave it alone. I don't care if you were in the Army or the Marines 20 years ago. Don't touch this stuff. You know, these type of situations, whether it's packages, powders, liquids, materials, containers, explosives, some of them are kind of obvious what they are. And some of these, even incidents that we've had here locally, sometimes it's very kind of an unknown and you're not sure what you're looking at. Leave this stuff to the bomb squads. You have to recognize you're going to have to wait on a bomb squad. And it's better that you wait. Let them handle that with their training experience and their robots and things like that. So kind of we always want to talk about prevention. You know, what are things we can do locally, our responders out on the road, people working in security, corporate world. Number one, ID of precursor materials. When these individuals are making these devices, they have to go somewhere and do it. They normally don't have a hidden bunker in the mountain somewhere. They're in a trailer. They're in their mom's basement, they're in their house, they're somewhere making this stuff. So if we can identify that prior to it being put together, and same thing in any type of clandestine lab, methamphetamine, drugs, explosives. So we've got to have awareness on routine calls. Again, the 9/11 hijackers, we ran into these guys prior to these incidents. All these incidents, we come across these individuals. They garner attention. People are concerned about them, aware of them. So we've got to have awareness on routine calls. So garages, workshops, and basements. These people have to do this stuff somewhere, and they have to drive around. Networking partners, as I said earlier, reach out to your local law enforcement. Reach out to Fire and EMS. Think of unified command and everything you're doing. We always hear about stovepipes. We'll never get out of the stovepipes, but let's try to connect those. Let's be careful posting our plans on the Internet. I still find organizations are posting their community's terrorism response plans online. And I think maybe we need to think about that, doing that. Because the bad guys, they do research. They do pre-operational surveillance. They plan on these things, too. So we got to be careful about posting our plans. Identify target hazards in your area, you know, special events, critical infrastructure, large corporations, high-profile locations. Information sharing. We've all got to share information here. There's a lot of different ways to do that. But I go back to the Boston bomber. We knew about them. Nadal Hassan, we knew about him. Our school shooters, we normally know about these guys. We're familiar with them. So we've got to be able to share information. And a lot of times these individuals are doing, I'll just call it weird things. They're doing surveillance. They're researching things. They're posting things on the Internet that's just weird. Or in the threat world, you would call inappropriate behavior and communications. They're doing things to garner attention. So if something does not look right, you know, obviously we need to, see something, say something. So kind of closing here, I think the best chance for detecting or learning about these terrorist attacks or mass violence incidents, once they're on their way to the target and successfully stopping them, is it pretty much slim to none. Unlike the movies or the TV show 24, which I did used to watch, pretty good, but real life is not like that. So the only way to do that is us sharing information and intelligence, gathering that information, and trying to use prevent these things from happening, getting in front of them before they occur. Also, I want to make everybody aware, just FYI, if you're on the East Coast, we're going to have a large Joint AT Mass Violence Planning and Response Symposium, kind of talk about these things, couple speakers, vendors related to the topic, August 5th in Charlotte, North Carolina, and August 6th, Durham, North Carolina, which is next door to Raleigh. And you guys can look up threatsuppression.com or just contact me offline. So just wanted to make you aware of that since we are talking about this topic today. So I think that is my closing window, closing slide there, Amy. I will tell everybody, you know, please be safe, guys, and I will hand it back to you, Amy.
Thank you very much, August. We really appreciate it. Folks, if you have any further questions specifically on this material, we'll go to those first, and then if we have time, we'll get to the ones that are further afield. I do have one from Russell Selwood. This is basically on the first part of your presentation, and he asks, is there a watch list of specific domestic groups available?
Watch list, that's kind of a controversial term there. As far as an official watch list, I don't really know. And it's, again, it's kind of hard to, there's so many different groups out there. I would just kind of recommend, there's groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Anti-Defamation League, some of those things are kind of readily available. That's not saying I endorse any organization. But some of these groups do kind of maintain some lists, but it may be up to you to identify that list. So as far as a specific watch list, no, because every state is different, every region is different, and some of these areas, some of the groups are just, it's a group and they're not doing criminal activity, subversive activity. And I don't know if that's a good answer.
But probably you would recommend what you responded earlier in terms of who to go to for finding out about your regional threats.
Talk about local state law enforcement, your fusion centers, your gang units. Every area is different. And a lot of this, a lot of these, if you have a special event, RNC, DNC, WTO, G8 summits, presidential visits, things like that, controversial issues on campuses, a lot of time those are magnets for groups to come in that may not normally be around. But sometimes it is an event or activity that may bring these individuals or these groups into your area.
All right. One of the things I was wondering about is, you know, with the Boston event, I understand that because they had so much experience with that Boston Marathon that they treated it like it was going to be a mass casualty event, so had so many resources available immediately. Do you think there's going to be even more thinking and planning in the future in terms of incorporating these kinds of issues into that special events planning?
Yeah, number one, I look at special events as a, and we even try to do that here. I mean, we have ACC football games, we have big events, we've had multiple presidential visits. So I think those a special event, planned event, is sort of an opportunity to set up a unified command, come together and do planning. do an incident action plan, do a vulnerability assessment, do a threat assessment, do your maps, your communications plans. And it depends on the event. Even a little parade in a small community, that's a chance for everybody to come together and talk about that event and put things in place. And I know Boston had taken the stance in years before this event, kind of familiar with that, they treated every one of these events as a disaster already.
Right.
So I think when this event occurred in Boston, they already had a command post, and they went to the bombing page. They were already operating that many people, and they flipped to the, in the guide, flipped to the tab that said bombing and started that operation. So I think that's the best way to be prepared, is already have that command post set up, those plans in place. It's just a valuable tool when you're planning these kind of things out.
Question from Ava Jean, and she says, thanks for the good information, August. Should people be concerned about their mail regarding mail bombs or harmful materials? And if so, what should people look for and be aware of?
Well, I think it depends on who you are and what you're doing. General public, probably not. I'd be more afraid of someone stealing my mail and doing identity theft. The general public, why do I say that? Every year we get our suspicious powder calls here that we respond out on, and most of the time it's the general public that receives a laundry soap sample in the mail. So I think now if you're the CEO of a bank,
mm-hmm.
or governor, the president, you're involved in something controversial, something's going on, then obviously your threat, your risk goes up a lot. But really the general public, I don't know if we really be. Like I said, I'd be more concerned about people. That's what I'm more concerned about, people stealing my mail because it sits in the mailbox. But if you're receiving death threats or things like that, could you receive powder or some type of materials? There has been these incidents have happened. 2 years ago in Maryland, you had several state buildings. The mail rooms caught fire because someone sent incendiary devices through the mail. We've had the recent ricin threats and incidents again. Remember, ricin is very easy to make. So what would we be concerned about if you're getting mail and, the whole misspellings, unknown stains, if there's wires hanging out and powder falling out, then I would call that a clue. And that's what happens with a lot of these incidents. And sometimes people still open them. So I think a lot of it depends on who you are and what the threat and the risk is to you.
Okay, I'm going to take a couple questions we had waiting that were a little afield. But Marcia Cronk says, what are your thoughts on shelter in place versus hide or run during active shooter events? And before you address that, August, I wanted to point out to Marcia that August has done some programs for us in the past, specifically on these active shooter events, and November or so, or October, that's in our archives, and if you're interested in that topic in particular, unfortunately, those never seem to go out of style either. So, all right, August.
Yeah, on that, the first thing I'll recommend is everybody to write down a name called Run, Hide, Fight. The city of Houston just put out a couple months ago, but I strongly encourage it since it came out. There's a video called Run, Hide, Fight. It's free. It's about 5 minutes long, and it's an excellent video. I had my own wife and kids watch it. It's a really good video. You share it with your family, friends, churches, any place you can think of that asks. Everyone who listened in today, you're now advocates and trainers. So share that information. I think sometimes it's terminology. Can I lock down a school? I probably can lock down majority of schools, but a college campus, it's nearly impossible to lock down a giant campus with multiple buildings. So sometimes I've heard that referred to as the shelter in place versus a lockdown. My first suggestion is if you can run for your life and get away from somebody doing something like that, run for your life. That's what I told my wife and kids. If it takes 5 minutes for this guy to get to you, I wouldn't want you to wait there hiding under your desk with a flimsy lock, blocking between you and the threat. So my first thing I would say is, people need to run and get away. And that goes along with that run, hide, fight. If you can't run, that's when you're going to try to hide. You're going to turn lights out, lock doors, locked, put desks, chairs, tables, everything you can to block yourself in there. You're only trying to hold for a few minutes. And something to think about for the school systems that use the red and green cards. I've seen them, they lock down, turn their lights off, lock the doors, the kids hide, and then they put a card under the door that, in green that says, we're in here and we're fine. I don't know if you should do that anymore because really that's telling the bad guy that we are in here. So just something to think about. But a lot of that is just definitions. Lockdowns, run, shelter in place. I think it's kind of up to each jurisdiction to look at that and what they can realistically do. But I would tell everybody, take a look at that run, hide, fight video. That's a good one.
Excellent. Okay, I got one final one from Frank Bell, and he says, if the emergency alert system could more selectively transmit alerts like the wireless emergency alerts to cell phones is, would that be of assistance in alerting the public to terrorist incident alerts? And I'm not so sure. I do believe in Boston they did use the wireless alerts, and I presume it was a shelter-in-place type message. After the event.
I think most of this will be after the event, and I think he's referring to the new system that's in place, that's the wireless notifications for severe weather. Could those be used? Well, yes, they could be used. I think most time now, and there are resources in place for us, we would probably more quickly be able to do local notifications, you know, contacting, or if we had a serious threat, or obviously if law enforcement's looking for somebody, or if something's going to happen, or there's an alert, we would use every tool we had available to us, which in today's world is media, fax, reverse 911, phone trees, social media, and that wireless emergency alert system would probably be one component of many that we could use, I guess would be the best answer.
Very good. Okay, I think we are going to wrap it up there. On behalf of Ava Jean, myself, and all our participants today, thank you very much, August, for joining us. And we appreciate you taking the time to share this information with us.
Thanks.
Folks, before you do run off, please take a moment to give us a little feedback. And then our next program is scheduled for June 26th. When the previously scheduled program on cyber disruption response planning has been rescheduled. You may, if you're on our list, know that we had to reschedule that because of the Boston incident. Our guest will be Adam Werenberg, Project Director for the New England Regional Catastrophic Preparedness Initiative. So please do try to make plans to join us then. Thanks to everyone for participating today. And have a great afternoon. We are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.